Jesus gave the Great Commission to the apostles. He told them to go into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation. And he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. And of course, when Jesus talked about belief, he meant blind faith, right? If he did, I don't think we would expect to find any sort of rational argument for Jesus as the Messiah in the Bible. And we do. We find them on every single page. In fact, we're beginning an examination of the core facts of what constitutes the plan of salvation, what makes it possible. God's scheme of redemption, as we look at the kernel of the gospel. When we talk about the kernel of the gospel, for the purposes of this class, we have four key things in mind. And what are they? What's the first one? Christ what? He died. And what confirms that he died? He's buried. And then Christ, he was raised. And what confirms that he was raised? He was seen. That's right. He appeared. He was seen. On Sunday's discussion, we began to look at the first of these, the fact that Jesus died. If you ever wonder why we frame it this way, this is how Paul articulates it in 1 Corinthians 15, beginning in verse 3. He said, "I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that He was buried, and that He was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures." And then he goes on. Don't stop there. He said in verse 5, "and that he appeared." And you have this list of appearances. It's not an exhaustive list. It's not every single appearance that he made post-resurrection. I hope that I've got all those listed on our lesson for this study. But this is what we're looking at. Sunday morning, we began to look at the medical evidence for the suffering and death of Jesus as it is relayed to us in the gospel accounts. We have the four Gospels that record these facts. We also have two other books that talk about his appearances. That's the book of Acts. And then, of course, we have 1 Corinthians 15. So this is where these six texts are where we will focus for the next few classes. So on Sunday morning, we looked at page 8, the death of Jesus. Under the death of Jesus, we looked at point number 1, how the night that he was betrayed and arrested, his physical sufferings may have began before he was even arrested. The text tells us in Luke that his sweat became like drops of blood. Now that's hardly conclusive evidence. That's a simile. So it's a figure of speech. But sometimes in the Bible, those kinds of figures of speech also happen to be literally true. Herod was afraid to lay hands on John the Baptist because the people regarded him as a prophet. That's a simile, but it's also literally true. John was a prophet. Maybe this was true in Christ's case, maybe not. If it was, it does set the stage for greater blood loss by the time that he's scourged, because if he is actually excreting blood in his sweat, then his skin is becoming brittle, and that's going to make what he goes through later on that much worse for him. We also pointed out on number 2 that he suffered some physical abuse at his trial. Exactly what degree, we don't know. We don't know how long they beat him or how harshly. We do know that this goes on all night, and he is without sleep by the time he's nailed to the cross. And before he even gets to the cross, he is considerably weakened. And this is abundantly clear by the third thing that we're going to talk about on here. So let's look in Matthew chapter 27. Matthew chapter 27 and verse 26. This is after Pilate has tried to get out of all this. He can find no clear fault or guilt in Jesus that makes him worthy of the death penalty. But he's trying to placate the Jews. And one way for him to do that, to appease them so that he doesn't have a riot on his hands, is to have Jesus scourged. A scourging was a typical punishment prior to crucifixion. The aim of scourging was to weaken the victim through shock and blood loss. And what this means is before Jesus was even nailed to the cross, he was bleeding considerably. You'll note that the way Matthew writes it in verse 26, he released Barabbas for them, but after having Jesus scourged, he handed him over to be crucified. the information that we have about scourging does not come from the Gospels themselves. It comes from outside sources. I want to take a guess as to why maybe Matthew and Mark and John don't go into great detail as to what scourging involved and what it was like for the victim that experienced it.
Maybe the audience already knew what it was about.
Yeah, this would be like us talking about the gas chamber or the firing squad. You really don't have to go into a lot of detail today because most of us know what that pretty well consists of. And we wonder sometimes, why doesn't the Bible talk about this a lot more? I'd really like to know more about scourging and what it was like. Well, it was written for us, but not to us. Yeah, written to people in the first century, and they knew what this consisted of. If you look in 2 Corinthians, chapter 11, and verse 24, Paul goes through a catalog of his sufferings that he's experienced on behalf of Jesus in the course of fulfilling his ministry. And there seems to be an indication that he experienced something similar to this, perhaps not to the same degree. In verse 24, 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. The Jews could dispense this kind of punishment themselves. They had that leeway from their Roman overlords. But there was a limit on how much they could dish out. I forget how the math works, but it comes out to where they could only dispense 39. Now, there was a formula that they had where that was the limit that they could dish out. As far as we can tell in the gospel accounts, Jesus is not scourged by Jews, but by Romans. There were no restrictions on how many lashes they could dish out. The cords that they used to flog people were leather strips that had small balls of iron embedded in them, as well as sharp bone fragments from sheep. And the bones would shred the skin open, cause extensive damage to subcutaneous tissue. As I said, the whole purpose was to weaken the victim beforehand through shock and blood loss. A lot of times people would die just from the scourging alone. The metal balls were capable of inflicting very deep bruises on the victim. The victim was often scourged without clothing. We don't know if that was true in Jesus' case or not. Local custom would often dictate how a person was garbed, if they were at all, when this kind of punishment was dealt. People often needed to experience this beforehand, because if you didn't get scourged first, even a strong man on a cross might live for several days until, one source says, exposure, wild animals, insects, or birds resulted in their death. So this was considered a necessary evil for the punishment to take its course, according to Roman justice and the way that it was styled. If you look back in Matthew chapter 27, down in verse 27, after he is scourged prior to his crucifixion, the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole Roman cohort around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. Now, this is bad for the wounds that have already been inflicted on him. If you're taking the clothing off and putting it back on, you're reopening those wounds every time that the change of garments happens on the victim. They twist together a crown of thorns in verse 29. They put it on his head and a reed in his right hand. They knelt down before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." They spat on him and took the reed and began to beat him on the head. After they had mocked him, they took the robe off and then put his own garments back on him and led him away to crucify him. We don't know how severe the beatings were. This time it's indicated that they at least have a weapon in their hand to inflict the beatings with, and not just perhaps bare fists, as may have been the case in the first beating that he suffered. And when we think of the crown of thorns, the way it's often depicted is it's kind of a dark image of what the ghost of Christmas present might wear, the wreath around his head. But the trees in the Middle East that have thorns, one source says that probably the thorns are they're too great, too severe for someone to have twisted it into a wreath the way it's often depicted in paintings and so on. You're talking about thorns that may be an inch long. So it's not so much a wreath or a crown as it is maybe a helmet. They might have just taken a bundle of these and just placed it on his head and then started to beat him with it. Now, the scourging probably perhaps left him in critical condition as it was already. This is significant for people trying to figure out how it is that he actually came to die. Even Pilate seems to be surprised at how quickly Jesus died on the cross. Jesus is on there at most 6 hours, whereas most people would go 3 to 4 days. This was meant to be an agonizing process. So the crown of thorns may not have done anything as far as putting his life in danger with the beatings being inflicted, but you're talking about sensitive tissue, nerve areas. You're talking about great pain and discomfort being piled upon one another. And then you get to chapter 27 and verse 32. In chapter 27 and verse 32, as they were coming out, they found a man of Cyrene named Simon, whom they pressed into service to bear his cross. Now, if you compare this with John's account in John chapter 19, in verse 17, they took Jesus, therefore, and he went out bearing his own cross. In John's account, he says Jesus carried his own cross, but in the other three accounts that we have, Simon is press-ganged into carrying the crossbeam. Before we talk about how to harmonize that, let's just picture what's going on here. When they had to carry their cross to their own execution, they didn't carry the full T cross, not all of it, just the top horizontal crossbeam. That weighed maybe 75 to 125 pounds. So sometimes you'll see on the side of the road guys carrying a cross on their back and it's got wheels on the bottom. It was nothing like that as far as what they had to go through back then. That's still a heavy load, but Jesus is evidently, if I'm harmonizing this right, unable to carry it the full distance from the Praetorium all the way down to Calvary Hill. We don't know what happened. Some people suggest that he fell. That's entirely possible. If he did fall, that's bad for him because the crossbeam was often tied to the person's hands. So if he fell, he had nothing to break the fall. And it may have been that at that moment, perhaps, whether he fell or he just gave out, they decided to get Simon into his service to carry it the rest of the way. One thing I want to add here, and I hope to return to this principle in a later study, specifics do not exclude. They do not. And just because you have one text that says Jesus carried his cross and another that says Simon carried it, that does not necessarily a contradiction make. And we want to look at that at a later date when we talk about the agreement of the text. If you look in John chapter 19 down in verse 18, there they crucified him. Now, most of us know what this involves, the hands in his wrists and the hands in his feet. If you look over again in chapter 20 and in verse 25, again, Thomas is challenged to the other disciples when he refuses to believe their testimony. He says in verse 25, unless I see in his hands the imprint of the nails, put my finger in the place of the nails, my hand in his side, I will not believe. In the first century, the hand included the wrist. They did not nail people in the palm of the hand. That would not support the weight of the body. It would just rip right off. The wrist could support the weight of the body. And we may read Thomas talk about the hand in verse 25, but that would easily include the wrist as well. When you have nails driven into your wrist, it probably crushed, maybe severed the median nerve. He would have experienced agonizing pain shooting up and down both of his arms. his hands might have curled in on themselves like that. The feet, of course, were bound together, probably a single 7-inch stipe going through both of them. And, of course, most of us are familiar with the depiction of the body on the cross. As far as I can tell, those tend to be fairly historically accurate. It's a terrible way to go because your breathing is constricted. When you are in the Y position, your hands up and your body hanging, you have to push up to where you're more of a T position in order for there to be proper or better breathing. So there's a lot of things that are working against Jesus as he's on the cross. You'd have to force yourself up and down again and again. The pain would be excruciating. And that word excruciating comes from the Latin word excruciatus, which means out of the cross. When you talk about excruciating pain, we may not necessarily mean this literally, but it's pain out of the cross. It's great pain. That's the whole purpose of it. This is meant to be a public humiliation, and it's meant to send a psychological message as much as it is to take a life. When Alexander the Great conquered the city of Tyre around 300 BC, he slaughtered about 6,000 men that were capable of defending the city. Then he sold 30,000 people into slavery. But the siege took longer than he wanted it to, and he lost more people than he wanted it to. So for his anger and frustration, he saved that for 2,000 people that he crucified on the beach. This is a terrible thing to do to people, and that's the whole point. If you want to just kill somebody, there's a lot more efficient methods of doing it. This is meant to be a slow, drawn-out, awful process. Look over back in John chapter 19. Now, what killed Jesus exactly? We don't know. We do know that he died, and we know he died on the cross. Did his heart rupture? Did he suffocate? Was it from the shock? Was it from the blood loss? The scourging would have resulted in significant blood loss. The actual nails in his hands and feet, he wouldn't have bled much from that. But the scourging, it would have bled tremendously from before he even got on there. Was he dehydrated? We know he cried out, "I thirst." So he was, of course, dehydrated. Was it a heart arrhythmia, hypovolemic shock? We don't know. We know that he died. That's what's important to the Christian that believes that he came back. Not an exact medical explanation for how he died, but that he did die. In John 19, a text we've read a few times already, look in verse 32. Actually, verse 31. The Jews, because it was the day of preparation, so that the bodies would not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for the Sabbath was a high day, asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. So obviously, if you break the legs of the victim, they have that much more working against them in terms of breathing. This hastens death. In verse 32, the soldiers came, they broke the legs of the first man and of the other who was crucified with him. But coming to Jesus, when they saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. And he who has seen has testified, and his testimony is true, and he knows that he is telling the truth, so that you also may believe. Verse 34 is interesting. Obviously, John was impressed with what he saw to some degree. Why else would he bother to record it? This is an unusual thing. Two ways to explain it. Could have been miraculous. You don't have to explain it that way, though. There is a natural explanation that would fit it. Most commonly, what people suggest is that when the soldiers pierced his side in verse 34, they hit him probably in between one of the ribs, maybe pierced his pericardial sac, and a tremendous amount of bodily fluid would have come out that way. That may well be what happened. Maybe not. And I say maybe not because he's dehydrated. He says, "I thirst." Another explanation, when people die, blood turns to jelly. Your cells break down, and the water-looking serum separates from the blood. In verse 34, we just read that blood and water came out. We don't read that a tremendous amount of water and blood came out. It may not be the amount that's significant, but just the fact that the water and the blood separate. Now, to a soldier who is used to seeing dead people and the symptoms of a dead body, if he knows that at death, serum and blood separate, and a flow of water and blood would indicate, he wouldn't know this, but they would indicate cellular breakdown, which is consistent with death, for the soldier, that's all he needs to see to know that the man has died. The flow of blood in verse 34 obviously is not due to a pumping heart, but to gravity. He's suspended several feet in the air. He's hanging at an angle. He's just been punctured. There's an open hole, and now the blood is escaping from his body. Questions or comments on the evidence for Christ's death and suffering?
Todd,
yes?
On your carrying the cross thing, you mentioned that in John says that Jesus carried his cross. When you look at Matthew and Mark, it appears that Simon carried his cross. How do you reconcile that? If you had Luke 23:24, it appears that both of them carried the cross. Because it says Simon placed his cross on him. Carried the cross behind Jesus. It's possible that through this journey that Jesus maybe carried it part way and then he needed help, Simon helped. And then it's possible that Jesus couldn't carry it anymore and Simon carried it the rest of the way.
Okay, good remark there, Rocky. In Luke chapter 23, Luke may well provide the easiest way to harmonize what's going on with Jesus carrying the cross and then it being transferred over to Simon. I may have said Joseph earlier. I meant Simon, being transferred over to Simon to carry the cross. Yes, sir.
As I sit here listening to you describe the crucifixion, it certainly makes any excuses that we make for not giving Christ our all pretty silly, pale, sad.
I can't agree more. Dylan?
Something that kind of comes to mind to me is Luke really doesn't cover much about the signs of death per se as a physician. Where the blood and the water to him could have been a very natural thing, just like the soldiers, where he doesn't think it's remarkable, but it doesn't comment on it as being a physician and saying that several times. Whereas John is, what is that?
That's a good point. So Luke's the physician. He doesn't talk about the blood and the water coming out. If the second explanation I mentioned is correct, it's no big deal to him. He's seen that before. John's a fisherman. He's used to seeing dead fish, not dead people. So yeah, it would stick out in his mind. Good point. All right, let's talk about his burial. In Matthew chapter 27, we are told that there came a rich man, verse 57, from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him. He took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in the rock. And he rolled a large stone against the entrance of the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene was there, and the other Mary sitting opposite the grave. It's interesting to me that we know so much about the burial of Jesus. If I was writing one of the Gospels, I wouldn't be so interested in this, perhaps. I'd want to know more about his adolescence and other things. But we know an awful lot about his burial, which again lends some credibility to what they say. Not only did he die, but he was buried. And the manner in which he's buried is remarkable because it really raises a huge stumbling block to a lot of naturalistic theories that are offered as an alternative explanation for the resurrection. Let's talk about a few of these. We know who buried him. We know who owned the tomb. We know that when the body was laid within the tomb, we know that some women went there. Not only did they see where the body was laid, they actually saw how it was laid within the tomb. All this is going to be important down the road because one of the explanations that people offer is that the ladies went to the wrong tomb. Even though it's a fresh tomb, they know the owner, they know where it was, and they know exactly how the body was laid within the tomb. I'm not so convinced that they would forget where the tomb was. If you look where we just read in Matthew 27 in verse 59. Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen cloth. Look over in John chapter 11.
Have you heard of the Shroud of Turin?
I have. Yeah, I don't know that there's any evidence to support the Shroud of Turin being a burial a garment of Jesus. If you look in John chapter 11 and verse 44, after Jesus says, "Lazarus, come forth," the man who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings. When they buried people, they buried them mummy style. Now, there were some variations on this. A man like Lazarus evidently was not embalmed. If you look back in verse 39, Jesus said, "Remove the stone." Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he has been dead 4 days." Now, they're not worried about this, as far as we can tell, in the case of Jesus, after he's been dead 3 days. But that's because he's been embalmed. A rich man buried him. He could afford it. Lazarus and his sisters evidently did not have much money. In the case of Lazarus, if you were not embalmed, they did not bind your legs together. So if Jesus tells him to come forward, he can walk out on his own two legs. But then he tells them in verse 44, "Unbind him and let him go." He needs help with the rest of it. But Jesus evidently is not buried this way. Look in John 19. While he's wrapped up the same as Lazarus, he's got a lot of extra weight with his corpse. In John chapter 19 and verse 39, Nicodemus, who had first come to him by night, also came, bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen wrappings with the spices, as is the burial custom of the Jews. This is a means of showing great respect for this man. And obviously Joseph would do that, being a disciple of Jesus Christ. Wealthy people, powerful people, rulers, they were buried with a lot of these things to help mask the stench of decay and to preserve the body somewhat. Lazarus doesn't have this. Jesus does, so he's wrapped up a little bit tighter even than Lazarus was. And not only that, he's weighed down considerably more than Lazarus was. Now, this is interesting for the people that say Jesus didn't actually die on the cross. He passed out. Instead of coming back from the dead, he just revived, as it were, and then got out. He's got a lot working against him. He's got median nerves that have been destroyed in his hands. I don't know how he's going to push that stone back. I don't even know how he's going to get out of the wrappings. I don't know how he's going to sit up in the first place. He's got 100 pounds of weight on him. Hasn't eaten or drinking for 3 days. Drunk for 3 days. He's lost a lot of blood. He's incredibly weak by what he's been through. A lot working against people that offer an alternative solution. We have the burial stone in Mark chapter 15. Look back at Mark chapter 15 and verse 43. Joseph of Arimathea came, prominent member of the council. He gathered up courage, went in before Pilate. He asked for the body. I meant to read this a moment ago. Verse 44. Pilate wondered if he was dead by this time. Pilate is surprised. Jesus died pretty quick. But he summoned the centurion and questioned him as to whether he was already dead. And ascertaining this from the centurion, he granted the body to Joseph. Pilate is satisfied. The centurions are satisfied. They poke the spear in him. Everybody's satisfied. He's dead. So Joseph takes the body in verse 46. And at the end of the verse, he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Now, in chapter 16 and verse 3, when the women come to the tomb on the first day of the week, they were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" Might almost make it sound like Joseph of Arimathea had super strength, like Samson. But the way these tombs were set up, the stone was rolled uphill. and maybe there's some smaller stones or bricks that would chalk it in place, and all you had to do was just kick them out and gravity would do the rest of the work and roll right on down. So Joseph only has to knock it out of the way. It's a huge stone, apparently, because we have several women who can't roll it back for themselves. They're going to need some help. As we can see in Mark chapter 16, there is a large, large impediment to getting out of that thing easily. Back in Matthew chapter 27, in verse 62, on the next day, the day after the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered together with Pilate. They said, "Sir, we remember that when he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I am to rise again.' Therefore, give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal him away and say to the people, 'He has risen from the dead.' The last deception will be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard, go, make it as secure as you know how." They went and made the grave secure. First way they do that is by putting a guard at the tomb. Now, who is this going to deter?
The disciples.
Anybody. The disciples especially is who they're worried about, but it would deter anybody. You've got Roman centurions, if they're Romans. There's some debate over exactly who this is. Is it the Romans or temple guards? Either way, there's guys standing there to guard it. So, if you're going to suggest the grave robbery theory, not only do you have this huge, massive stone, which perhaps enough men could roll out of the way, but you've got this guard stationed in front of it. Now, there's another thing mentioned in verse 66. Along with the guard, they set a seal on the stone. This is at the top of page 9. They sealed the tomb. Now, what was this like? Probably rope, cords that were fastened across the stone on top of the tomb. They would have been fixed on either side of the entrance to the tomb with wax or clay, and there would have been a similar fixture probably in the center of the stone sitting in front of the tomb. And this was supposed to be like the police ribbon at a crime scene. Do not enter. It was also meant to let anybody know if it had been tampered with, because if you messed with the cords, you broke the seals. Presumably, the seals would be fastened with some kind of signet ring or something bearing a mark of imperial authority. And if you were a grave robber, that would not be an easy thing to counterfeit, to try to cover your tracks, as it were, if you left any signs of trying to get in. So there's a lot working against people that suggest a naturalistic explanation in the form of theft getting into the tomb. So it's quite a boon to our faith for us to know that we have so many details about not just the death of Jesus Christ, but the burial as well. Thoughts or comments on the death or the burial of Christ as it is conveyed to us in what we've read? Yeah, Keith.
You talked about the fact that it's beneficial to us for all the facts that we do have of this burial. I think the silence is deafening when it comes to the facts or lack thereof of any tampering or anything else. Like, you know, I think it was that Jesus, after he was raised, appeared over the next 40 days to different people. And in this time period would have been when you have gotten your Sherlock Holmeses and people, anybody and everybody out there. If this tomb is empty, this is the person that they just publicly crucified, who, you know, they have been denouncing. They say he's a deceiver. They believe that he's misrepresenting what a true Messiah is going to be. That will be the time that you get your best people out there to figure out what was going on, what proof could you provide, and there's nothing left for us. So not only do we have all this proof of the burial, but we have nothing else recorded in the way of being able to take away from any of this, to detract from just what was left for us. And I think that, to me, is just as important as the fact that we have all these details about it. The burial, nothing was left to counteract anything. It's just conjecture today.
Yeah, the question is, where is the body? So the Jews had no motive to steal the body, but if they had, why didn't they just present it 40 days later or 50 days later at Pentecost? It's preserved as best they know how. We know where it was buried. We know who had it buried. We know a lot. It would not be difficult to track it down and find out where the body is based on what we know. Alex? Okay. You don't have anything to say? Just waving?
Well, I was going to say...
Okay.
You know, my atheist friend was telling me that, you know, Christ was
was in a coma. Everything's explainable scientifically, but he had nothing to say when I tell him, well, how about that he was getting speared on the side? I don't know too many people in a coma that you stick a spear on their side and live, you know, wake up 3 days later, they're probably bleed to death.
So, yeah, I don't know why they would be so insistent upon that. All the evidence suggests that he experienced a catastrophic event to his body and wouldn't have survived that. And we even have secular testimony of enemies of Christianity that confirmed as well that he died by crucifixion. So you're reaching if you say that he survived it. I wanted to point out Acts chapter 12 and verse 19 when we read about Peter the jailbird. Acts chapter 12, verses 18 and 19. Now when day came, there was no small disturbance among the soldiers as to what could have become of Peter. When Herod had searched for him and had not found him, he examined the guards and ordered that they be led away to execution. Then he went down from Judea to Caesarea and was spending time there. Of course, those words to execution are in italics, verse 19, but evidently the translators felt there was enough good evidence to let the reader know that this is what's to become of them because they have been derelict in their duty. At least that's the way Herod's interpreting it. You've not done your job. So here's these guys, they've been put in front of the tomb of Jesus Christ. How much incentive do they have to make sure there is no robbery? Buddy, if you don't prevent a grave robbery, it's going to be your body in that tomb. What if lawyers had to suffer the penalty of the people they defended and they didn't get them off the hook? How much harder would they work to make sure their defendant was found not guilty? If they're going to the gas chamber and I go too, yeah, buddy, you can better believe I'm going to make the best defense ever seen. Here are guys that have their own necks on the line.
Todd, we may not know exactly what they would say. You already indicated what Herod would do. But the jailer thought it was better to commit suicide than face whatever it was.
Good point. Yeah, so the Philippian jailer in Acts 16, when he realizes his prisoners are no longer there, he's just going to take his own life. Better to do it myself than for my superiors to do it to me. So, we have a lot of things here working against those that suggest another means of the body escaping from the grave. All right, talk just for a couple minutes about his resurrection. First of all, no one sees the exact moment that Jesus came back to life. Nobody's there next to the body. They don't hear the heart start to pump once more. They don't have a hand on his wrist to feel a pulse, nothing like that. Seems to me that if the story was made up, that would have been recorded. Of course, it would be different in some other ways as well. I don't know that the women would have been the first ones to find the tomb empty had it been invented. I don't know that they would have had more faith in what Jesus said prior to his death than the disciples did if this had been invented. A lot of embarrassing details stacked up in here. Look back at Matthew chapter 28. The tomb was found empty on Resurrection Sunday. Matthew chapter 28 and verse 2. A severe earthquake had occurred, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven, came and rolled away the stone and sat upon it. So the stone is rolled back. Now why is it rolled back? Is it rolled back so that he can get out? This is a guy that had no trouble getting into a locked room where the door was shut, just instantly appearing after he comes back from the dead. The stone is rolled back not so that he can escape, but so that other people can look inside. And notice that not only is the body gone, but there's some other interesting things about this as well. Look in Luke chapter 24. Peter hears about the empty tomb. Verse 12, he got up, he ran to the tomb, stooping and looking in. He saw the linen wrappings only. He went away to his home, marveling at what had happened. I don't know that if the body had been stolen, that the linen wrappings would have been left there. If he's wrapped up mummy style, it might be just a whole lot easier to pick him up and carry him that way. But not only are they left there, there's another curious thing about it. In John chapter 20, verse 6, Simon Peter followed him, that is John. He entered the tomb, he saw the linen wrappings lying there, the face cloth which he had seen, which had been on his head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. If you're robbing a grave, are you going to stop and take the time to roll and fold up neatly the garments that you're ripping off the dead body? Strange credulity to me. I would think you'd be in a hurry to get out as quick as you can. Curious things, and again, things that I would not expect to find, things that I would not have thought to have included if I was just making this up. In Matthew chapter 28, you have the first explanation offered as to how the tomb came to be empty. You'll notice once again that in the first century, the debate was never whether or not the tomb was empty. It was only how it came to be that way. So in chapter 28 and verse 13, the Jews tell the guards, "You are to say his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep." How would they know what happened if they'd been asleep? That's just stupid. So we're going to stop here. We're past time. Thank you, Ennis. And thanks, everyone, for your attention.